It's going to take another podium to host a GOP gubernatorial debate this year as Mesa Mayor Scott Smith jumps into the race. With only one Democrat on the ballot, does Smith's candidacy change anything?
You'll get a lot of independents who decide to choose a Republican ballot in the primary. So you're going to have to appeal to both conservative and moderate Republicans, but also those independents.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, we consider the race for the Republican nomination for governor. The current governor gives her State of the State address on Monday as the legislature gets back to work. We'll look ahead to this year's legislative session.
We'll review Xanadu and visit a condom factory. Those are unrelated stories.
And hockey. The Coyotes are last in the league in attendance so far this season, but that could be changing.
The goal that we've set for ourselves is to be in the middle of the pack of the NHL.
Plus, Phoenix inventories its vacant property and a look at really, really old colors.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Economists are mulling over a lackluster jobs report the Labor Department released today. 74,000 jobs were added to payrolls in December, not nearly as many as the economy had seen each month since August. The unemployment rate is also down from 7% to 6.7%. More Americans were left out of the government unemployment count because they were not looking for jobs. Some analysts say it's largely because people can't find work. But others, such as private economist Robert J. Shapiro, say you also cannot discount a growing number of baby boomers entering retirement.
The movements from one month to another, we can't pay much attention to. The long-term decline in labor participation coincides with the beginning of the retirement of the boomers.
Shapiro served as Undersecretary of Commerce during the Clinton administration. Federal authorities are sending in more than 1 million liters of bottled water from Maryland to West Virginia today. Tens of thousands in Charleston and surrounding areas are unable to consume their tap water because it might have been contaminated by a chemical spill in the Elk River. Jeff McIntyre, president of the West Virginia American Water Company, says the water should be off limits to everything but flushing.
Don't make baby formula with it. Don't brush your teeth with it. Don't wash with it. Don't shower with it. Don't drink it.
President Obama has declared 9 counties federal disaster areas. The Justice Department is extending federal recognition to the marriages of more than 1,000 same-sex couples in Utah, where those unions are now being legally challenged by the state. Here's NPR's Carrie Johnson.
Attorney General Eric Holder says about 1,000 couples who married in Utah before courts put a stop to the practice will be eligible for all federal benefits. Utah's governor says the state will not recognize those unions while lawsuits proceed, but Holder says the families should not be forced to endure uncertainty about their status as the cases move through the court system. The Obama Justice Department's been working to extend federal benefits to same-sex married couples since the Supreme Court ruled last June that Americans in legal same-sex unions are entitled to equal protection and equal treatment under law. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Reports of sexual assault are down at U.S. military academies, according to the Pentagon. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports two of the three elite academies saw a decrease.
The Air Force Academy logged the highest number of sex crimes, but that may indicate that Air Force cadets feel more confident about telling authorities. Major General Jeff Snow leads the Pentagon's effort against sexual assault. He said a culture of harassment can lead to rape.
Sexual assault is a crime and has no place at the academies, just as it has no place in our armed forces.
Advocates insist the military must change its justice system to ensure effective punishment of rape in the ranks.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to ensure all Americans have access to health care at rwjf.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for tonight. We're expecting clear skies and lows in the mid-40s. Then for this weekend, mostly to partly sunny skies, warming up quite a bit. Highs both Saturday and Sunday of 72, currently clear and 63 degrees. Meanwhile, one traffic thing to tell you about, 202 westbound the Red Mountain Freeway. Left lane's blocked at 40th Street.
In the news this hour, a partial power outage at ASU's Tempe campus is over. Power was out for about a quarter of the Tempe campus for about 3 hours this morning. The partial outage began when a water leak damaged equipment at the central power plant. The university is still on winter break. Classes resume on Monday.
The federal government wants to buy two pieces of private ranch land inside the Agua Fria National Monument, 40 miles north of Phoenix, to add to the protected site. The two 40-acre parcels are part of the Cross Y Ranch. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management hopes to eventually buy all but about 100 acres of that ranch. The Conservation Fund previously bought two of the four ranch parcels to protect them from development. The group's 706 acres include the two parcels the BLM hopes to buy once a public comment period closing today ends. The Prescott Daily Courier reports the BLM is using about $250,000 from a special federal fund to make the purchase.
Authorities say they've discovered an incomplete smuggling tunnel along the U.S.-Mexico border in Nogales. U.S. Customs and Border Protection says the unfinished tunnel was found this week during a joint effort by U.S. and Mexican authorities. Officials say authorities noticed freshly disturbed dirt within the channel floor of a drainage system near a port of entry in Nogales. They later discovered a tunnel that began in Mexico and extended 133 feet into the U.S., but it did not yet have an opening from the ground. More than 75 such underground passages have been found along the border since 2008, concentrated largely in California and Arizona.
Mesa Mayor Scott Smith waited and then waited a little bit more. Then on Thursday, he officially jumped into the race to be Arizona's next governor. On the Democratic side, Fred Duvall may be the lone candidate, but Smith joins a crowded GOP field, one with a lot of well-known names. State Treasurer Doug Ducey, Secretary of State Ken Bennett, and disbarred former Maricopa County Attorney Andrew Thomas. Former GoDaddy executive Christine Jones and former state lawmaker Al Melvin are also in the mix. Consultant Barrett Marson of Marson Media knows Republican battles. He was a spokesperson for former Arizona House Speaker Jim Wires and the state prison system. Scott Smith is in the gubernatorial race. It kind of feels like the field is complete. What do you think about Smith jumping in, first of all? And what about his timing?
It is not too late, I don't think. I think this is going to be a fun Republican primary. You know, it's going to be a crowded field. 30% may win this field and go on to face Fred Duvall. Everyone's got their own little niche, except for, quite frankly, Ken Bennett and Scott Smith. They share niches, and I think that's going to be difficult. Scott Smith has been mayor, has done a really good job at being mayor in Mesa, and Ken Bennett is well-liked. He's affable, and they're both seen more as moderates. Doug Ducey, obviously very conservative, and he's got such a money advantage right now. People talked about almost expecting him to raise $1 million, and, well, you know, he certainly met those expectations, and he did it in part under the old and the new contribution rates. So he did great, I think.
The GOP primary voters, there's always the stereotype, which may in fact be true, that they tend to be more conservative than the average Republican voter. If that's the case, who do you think is going to win out then?
Because there's not a lot of excitement on the Democrat side, you'll get a lot of independents who decide to choose a Republican ballot in the primary. There really are almost no races on the Democrat side of the ticket. So you're going to get a lot of independents. So you're going to have to appeal to both conservative and moderate Republicans, but also those independents.
What about the Q rating that you see at this point? Because Scott Smith, you know, really well-known around the Valley, of course, and he took that little listening tour or whatnot, as candidates have to do. But he's the mayor of Mesa, whereas you've had Bennett and Ducey have both been elected statewide.
I know the name Doug Ducey, and you know the name Scott Smith, but I'm telling you, not a lot of people out there. Even though Bennett and Ducey have been elected statewide, they're really not known because, let's face it, treasurer and secretary of state don't get a lot of attention. Now they're hitting the big time, and they're going to buy TV ads, and we're going to see a lot of TV ads, and voters are going to get to know them in May, June, July real quick. But I don't think any of these candidates are well known, even those that have run statewide and won statewide.
How nasty could this get? Because people might see themselves as saying, I need to get myself out front. I'm going to use the money to portray the other candidates, or are they going to try to pump themselves up?
If it's an election, that means candidates will abhor going negative right before they go negative. And so I would expect a lot of negative advertising about Scott Smith and his liberal policies in Mesa, or about Doug Ducey and some of the Cold Stone Creamery things that we heard about in the last election from Andre Cherney. There's going to be a lot of things. You know, Ken Bennett will have his peccadilloes as well. Trust me, voters will hear about every negative thing out there, despite the fact that all the candidates would love to just talk positively about themselves.
Barrett Marson of Marson Media. You can also catch his podcast. It's called Copper Talk. Barrett, thanks.
Thank you.
State lawmakers return to the Capitol on Monday when Governor Jan Brewer gives her State of the State address. And while there are a lot of issues they'll take up this year, one seems to be at the top of both Democrats' and Republicans' minds. We'll hear from leaders of both parties, starting with House Speaker Andy Tobin.
Clearly, in everyone's mind is the CPS crisis that we're going through. Very anxious to hear what the governor has to say on Monday about it. So clearly, I think the members have been very patient. They're looking for some clear results to see what's now happened since we've all found out about this. And then they're anxious to get to be a part of the solution. So right now, a lot of members are, you know, hey, what can we do to help? And I asked Mr. Flanagan the same. I said, we want to help. What is it you need? And he didn't give me a list. You know, and I told him, I said, well, you got members who are willing to do whatever it takes, and then let's go get this right for once. I remember when I came down, I mean, CPS always seems like every so many years it's a huge crisis, and it's not forgivable. So I think we need to move ahead and find a final solution to it. And I've got some ideas of my own, so we'll see what they recommend.
Can you share some of your ideas?
Well, sure. I've always felt CPS should be on its own. I mean, you know, that's such a large agency. Clearly, this is out of control, and it needs to have, in my view, needs to have a separate director unto itself, a cabinet position person, and they need to have the resources, and they need to be able to have attainable goals, and maybe and be able to say, hey, I need this money because.
So other than CPS, what other big issues do you think we should look for this year?
Well, you know, the economy continues to be part of my mission. You know, I was here, you were down there with me, you know, when everything blew up and we weren't sure we had payroll. This state has come from a place where we weren't sure we were going to have much of a state left to a place where Forbes magazine says that this is the best place in the next decade to grow jobs. That's an incredible turnaround in a short period of time. But that doesn't mean we're back where we should be. I think there's room on the budget to actually adjust for revenue improvement, but you don't want to go so far that 3 years from now you find you put the state back in the same spot they were in when, you know, when we got down here. Similarly, it's important that you spend some money to invest. You have to invest in economics and in the economy, and that's you want to make sure you have a workforce that's, you know, our community colleges, our university system, or education system. And you got to make sure that you put money back in roads. So so you see that as a, you know, some priority legislation that's moving right now, too.
Last year ended on kind of, for some people, a sour note with all the acrimony with the Medicaid expansion plan, the special session the governor called.
Right.
Do you get the sense that you and your caucus and the House Democrats and the Senate and the governor are all going to be able to work together this year?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're professionals. I was disappointed the way it ended last year. Didn't have to go that way. You know, I'm not going to sit there and vote no on K-12 because somebody voted yes on Medicaid. And I don't know a member who's going to do that.
2014, as you all know, is an election year.
Yeah, big election year.
Pretty much everybody at the legislature is up for either re-election or, in your case, and in some other cases, running for other offices.
Right.
Do you expect that to lead to a shorter session than we've seen in the past few years?
Well, ordinarily, I would say yes. And most members really do want to get out. You don't see a lot of bills just yet. I'm sensing there'll be fewer. So that it usually is common with an election year. So, I think that by and large, the members are anxious to get back out there and campaign on what they've done in their communities.
That was House Speaker Andy Tobin. On the Democratic side, Senate Minority Leader Anna Tovar says the uninvestigated reports of child abuse and neglect are also her caucus's top concern.
Well, I would say our number one priority of our Senate Democratic caucus would be repairing CPS, and that issue, I know for us, is our number one priority in making sure that children are protected and making sure that this never happens to a child again. So we know that there's many possible solutions, but as a Democratic caucus, we are here to work together as a team in a bipartisan way to come to a solution.
Do you get the sense that there will be bipartisan work on this, that Democrats and Republicans will be able to agree on something to do with CPS?
I believe you'll have agreement on some issues. I think you'll see us not agreeing is maybe on the funding issue. And again, that is a key issue in making sure that CPS is a viable agency. But knowing that, you know, using, you know, statistics and knowing that number, you know, we're not just going to throw money at this issue. We need to be strategic on where this money is placed. You know, my personal concern on this is, you know, making sure we have those preventative services for our children. And, you know, and through the cuts through 2009 and 10, those preventative services were greatly damaged to our families and for our children.
On the budget, do you expect to see noticeably more spending or more cuts this year than we've seen over the past year or two?
I think you'll see probably a mix of both. And this is where I feel that as Senate Democrats, we play a crucial role in the budget as well. We are a body of 13. We are optimistic in working together and having a bipartisan budget.
There's been a lot talked about, a lot written about how everybody's going to get along in that chamber down the hall when the session starts after some of the hurt feelings from Medicaid. Recently, the Senate Democrats added to a bit of the contentiousness with the change in leadership. Are you guys going to be able to work together starting next week?
Absolutely. I mean, I know there, you know, like you had mentioned, other issues, things like this happen in the legislature. We are no different than any other type of company or any other type of family where disagreements do happen. At the end of the day, though, we are here to serve our constituents and families. So we're here to work for them and putting any of those personal issues aside.
2014, obviously an election year. Mm-hmm. All of you are up for either re-election to the legislature or to some other office. Mm-hmm. The obvious question in every other year is, do you think this is going to be a relatively short session?
Actually, I don't feel that it's going to be a very short session.
Why not?
I do feel that it's going to be a what we would call a typical session. Yes, it is an election year, but you know, again, I go back to our constituents, our families. They want us to tackle these very important issues. You know, the issue of a loan, a CPS, is going to take some time to come to viable solutions. The budget, education issues, jobs, you name it. So, you know, as Senate Democrats, we're not in a rush to get out of session. We will work here, and, you know, if it's going to take over 100 days, then that's definitely our job, and we'll roll up our sleeves and we'll be here as long as it takes.
Senate Minority Leader Anna Tovar. Governor Jan Brewer delivers her State of the State address on Monday afternoon, the official kickoff of the 51st Legislature's second regular session.
One of the priorities when the legislature begins its 2014 session next week, and which could draw bipartisan support, is the restoration of money to the Highway User Revenue Fund. HURF, as it's more commonly known, is used for road and street repair. But since 2002, nearly $750 million have been diverted toward other priorities. Ken Strobeck of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns says it's clear that especially rural areas need transportation-related money.
If you've driven around a lot of the state, we certainly need to have street improvements. We hear that all the time from citizens, from mayors. We think this year is the year to stop those transfers and to get back to the formula distribution and make sure that we get that money going where it's intended to go.
Based on the fact that Speaker Tobin and Minority Leader Campbell both seem to be on board with this, that does seem to be something that could move forward.
It's looking much better than it has the last few years. You know, this has been something we've talked about, and we've seen a lot of funds like the SLIF, the Lake Improvement Fund, airport funds. All those are either minimal or completely gone. HERF is the one that still is funded by the gas tax primarily, and people have an expectation, I think, when they're filling up their tank that they think that this gas tax is going to go to pay for streets and roads, and they don't realize that the majority of funding for highway patrol is now coming from sweeps of the HERF fund.
Ken Strobeck is executive director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. Chris Fetzer, executive director of the Northern Arizona Council of Governments, says the importance of HERF dollars cannot be overemphasized.
Like most areas across the state, our local governments rely on HERF for the maintenance and operation of their transportation infrastructure. And in most cases, it's the only resource that they have dedicated for that purpose.
What have the challenges been then in recent years as we've had such economic downturn? There have been those so-called sweeps of the legislature. How much has that affected what folks in Northern Arizona have wanted to do as far as those projects are concerned?
Well, it has many implications, but the most important, I think, is just the basic operation and maintenance of the system that cities and counties are responsible for. And it's forced many of our communities to take a look at their pavement maintenance cycles, extending those substantially over time. So basically, pavements get less attention, less preservation. They've had to look at maintenance policies and practices related to snow removal, which is of particular concern for local governments in northern Arizona, and just the added expense that our communities and counties deal with because of the weather. It's monsoon activity in the summer, the freeze-thaw cycle, and snow removal that all add cost to doing business for those agencies.
What are some things that, if in fact the legislature moves forward, can you give me some of the top priorities for Northern Arizona and maybe other rural areas up there?
The local governments would be looking to invest in the maintenance of their systems again, like they have. But they've also had to defer capital projects. And so there may be, in some cases, specific capital projects that get back on the books here in the next couple of years.
Chris, certainly transportation priorities can be a little bit different. In Maricopa County, there's a need to fix roads, but also a need for more public transit. In Northern Arizona, is the emphasis mostly on making sure the roads are maintained well?
Certainly, the highway network plays a prominent role in the daily lives of citizens in rural communities across Northern Arizona. And a lot of it's for commuting. It's similar purposes as in the metro area, but public transit options are not extensive and certainly not on a regional basis. They're mostly local. And so most people do depend on their private auto to get back and forth to work between communities, as well as accessing medical, which often citizens have to travel long distances to receive. So the highway system is of great importance.
Chris Fetzer, he's executive director of the Northern Arizona Council of Governments.
Still to come, we step into the Wayback Musical Machine, but our critic isn't ready to grow his hair big quite yet.
I want there to be more original musicals and less nostalgic navel-gazing.
A trip to Xanadu is ahead. It's the show.
As Mark so deftly put it, this is the show on KJZZ, where we're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. It's a new service that blends all the elements that make our world what it is. Valley weather for this weekend, it'll warm up quite a bit from today. We should be mostly to partly sunny both Saturday and Sunday, with high temperatures around 72, which would be about 7 degrees above normal. In Valley traffic, a couple of accidents to watch out for. I-17 northbound at Thunderbird, also the 51 southbound at Indian School. That collision has the right lane blocked.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona State University, offering more than 60 undergraduate and graduate online degree programs. Class descriptions and registration online at radio.asu.edu.
Phoenix's 500-plus square miles are dotted with vacant lots and empty buildings. Some of that property is owned by the city, and it presents opportunities to generate revenue, redevelop neighborhoods, or make city land use more efficient. But before Phoenix's leaders can put the land to its best use, first they need to know exactly what they've got. As KJZZ's Nick Blumberg reports, that process is underway.
The Barrister Place building in downtown Phoenix is at the southeast corner of Central and Jefferson. It's a beautiful historic building. It used to be the Jefferson Hotel. It's actually on the Register of Historic Places here. Now it's 38,000 square feet of office space owned by the city of Phoenix, and it's completely empty.
Should we be land banking, or should we be getting that out and get it developed to create jobs and create business in the city?
That's Phoenix's outgoing chief financial officer, Jeff DeWitt, speaking late last year. DeWitt said Phoenix has a list of all city-owned property for accounting purposes, but the parcels are all managed by different departments. Right now, Phoenix is looking to sell or lease three properties it doesn't need, including Barrister Place, and the city council has agreed to hire a brokerage firm to catalog all the city's vacant lots and empty buildings.
And not only look at whether it's vacant or not, but what's the planned use within the next 5 years? You know, we don't want to sell a piece of property that maybe housing has and find out that the police department's looking for the same piece of land.
If another department wants the land, it'll get transferred. But if there's no plan to do anything with it in the next 5 years, it'll be up for sale or lease, which could bring in millions in revenue. The new database will show the property's size and value, whether it's historically significant. DeWitt said all that information will help them market the property and get it off the city's plate.
If you got 10 acres set in the middle of a neighborhood, there's not only the drag on the neighborhood of vacant property, there's a cost to us to maintain it, mow it, make sure security's there. Maybe it has a building on it. We got to make sure it doesn't get broken into. We got to make sure that it's maintained and the neighborhood looks good.
There's another city-owned property that Phoenix hopes to unload. Unlike a historic building downtown, this is a 4.5-acre lot, empty except for some scrubby bushes and trees and trash. It's at the northwest corner of 12th Street and Greenway in North Phoenix. Even though it's in the middle of a developed neighborhood, this vacant lot could actually be useful, according to Armando Carbonell.
Having land available for development is probably part of the smooth functioning of the development process and keeps the cost of land at reasonable levels.
Carbonell is with the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy.
One could think of city-owned land in particular as an opportunity to advance some urban planning strategy, to think about how to provide more vitality in the downtown, to think of ways to support the use of light rail in Phoenix.
One group that's been working on urban planning in the Valley is the Discovery Triangle. It focuses on an area of the same name running between downtown Phoenix and downtown Tempe. Analyst Ali Anderson has collected a ton of data, not just about parcel ownership and zoning laws, but also things like
transportation systems and drive times and arts and culture and all of the schools in the area.
The group's CEO, Don Kuth, says it's pretty simple. Nobody prospers from vacant land.
It can be a blight, it can be an eyesore, it can be a breeding ground for the collection of trash, illegal activities, whatever the case might be.
Getting it developed can bring jobs, residents, retail, it adds to the tax base of local school districts, but as just about everyone knows, development took a huge hit during the recession.
I think you're going to see in 2014 a concerted effort to do just that. You didn't see it over the last 3 years because there wasn't a real estate market to do anything with.
Soon, Phoenix will be better poised to get its vacant property on that market. The database of excess city-owned property is set to be ready by the summer or early fall. Nick Blumberg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Lace up your roller skates. Here's theater critic Robert Pala.
I'm afraid I have seen Xanadu. I put it off as long as I could, but this hugely popular and perfectly dreadful stage musical, based on one of the worst movie musicals of all time, refuses to go away. Following its triumphant Broadway run in 2007, Xanadu took to the road, after which it began turning up in estimable playhouses like our own Arizona Theater Company. We are doomed, it would appear, to be forever reminded of a greasy-faced Michael Beck roller skating past garishly frescoed brick walls and crowds of extras dressed as mimes. Of poor Gene Kelly slumming his way through a wispy memory of his salad days when movie musicals were scored by Porter and Gershwin. We must revisit the undoing of the formerly upmarket Electric Light Orchestra. To recall a somnolent, gauzily clad Olivia Newton-John sleepwalking straight into a career lull from which she'd never recover. I want to take some pleasure in knowing that the theatrical Xanadu is in on the joke, because Douglas Carter Beane's book is a broad spoof of its sleazy cinematic counterpart. But I can't, because I want theatergoers and the people who are steering the musical theater industry to be past all this nudge and wink nonsense. I want there to be more original musicals and less nostalgic navel-gazing. I want there to be a phrase to describe the death of the musicalization of lamentable Hollywood blunders. But no one is asking me what I think, not Xanadu's producers, nor Olivia Newton-John fans, nor the droves of people who are going to line up to watch this musical satire of a bad movie about ancient Greek muses who come to Earth to inspire a roller disco. And certainly not Jeff Lynne of ELO, whose songs have been lifted wholesale from the movie, and who is, therefore, receiving giant royalty checks without lifting a finger. In any case, the opening night audience seemed to be enjoying themselves. We were asked to do a choreographed cheer, to cast a spell on an equity actor, and to sing along with some of the most flaccid pop music of the early 1980s. So, if it was painful to hear Jeff Lynne's multi-tracked original arrangements played by a puny band of four musicians, or to have to hear again the thudding banality of the Xanadu mega-hit Magic, it would appear it was painful only for me. And yet, to Xanadu I went. I had to. I was afraid that if I didn't go see Xanadu, it would track me down and force me to watch it. And I'm pretty certain that the only thing worse than a cheesy spoof of a crummy musical is a cheesy spoof of a crummy musical blasting away in my living room. For KJZZ, I'm Robert Paler.
Robert Paler's theater reviews appear each week in the Phoenix New Times, and there's more from Robert on the web at kjzz.org. Malaysia doesn't automatically spring to mind as the world's largest producer of condoms. After all, this is a conservative, Muslim-majority society where sex isn't generally openly discussed.
But Malaysia is also a big producer of rubber, the essential ingredient for all condoms, and that's why Malaysia's Carex has become one of the world's largest condom manufacturers.
Shares in Carex made their debut on the Kuala Lumpur Stock Exchange last month, and they've soared since. So the BBC's Jennifer Pack went to one of the company's factories in Malaysia to see what's keeping those shares up.
For every 10 condoms produced in the world, at least one comes from Malaysia. But it's likely that you've never heard of the company before, Carex. And that's because they mainly produce for international brands. Here, for example, they're producing chocolate-flavored condoms destined for Brazil.
This tiny piece of rubber protects people against pregnancies and diseases. So workers test every condom for holes before it's sold. Every time a machine rotates a metal probe in front of Chitra, he puts a black-colored condom on it.
Is it fun?
Today, condoms is just more than just a regular product.
The head of the company is Go Myak Kit.
How do you make the textures actually more stimulating?
So this one is called the
rough and tough.
Rough and tough.
And of course, we have also made colors. We have made more than just regular, normal colors like red and the blues. But we've even gone into producing like gold-colored condoms.
But also different flavors. I mean, it smells like bubblegum in here.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and we have all sorts of requests. Like Indonesia requested us for durian-flavored condoms.
Durian flavor.
Yes.
That's like the king of stinky fruit, right? For those who don't love it.
Oh, yes. And we did also one for a client in Amsterdam, a marijuana-flavored condom.
Marijuana flavor.
Yes.
I want to ask, how did you get the extract of that flavor?
It was all synthetically flavored. That you don't get any kick from that. You probably get the kick from, you know, the actual use of the condom.
But his biggest challenge may be the inflated male ego.
Yeah. And here is what we have. It's an air inflation test, and that's where we actually blow up the condom to see how much air and at what pressure the condom bursts at.
But I think this test is going to interest a lot of people because you said you get asked one particular question very, very often, which is what?
Well, men always have this thing about the size of the size of the penis, and everybody would like to say that, you know, they are very large. And always people like to tell me, I say, oh, your condom doesn't fit me. I say, well, if it doesn't fit you, I'll bring it to my factory and see how it fits you, you know. And if you look at the size of condom, right, I think it will practically fit anybody. It probably fit even your whole body, I'm sure.
That is something I hope not to try out.
The BBC's Jennifer Pack.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Okay, now.
Hi, I'm Daryl Horseman, and I'm teaching a Learn to Curl class at the Coyote Curling Club. It's almost like shuffleboard and bocce combined. Everybody throws two stones. Each stone is 42 pounds, and what we try to do is slide them down the ice and try to get them closest to the center of the rings called the house, and that's how we score.
No, it's got to curl into this one. Yep, now.
Every time you throw a rock, you get exponentially better. And every time you get better, the game just seems to grow with you. So you really, it's impossible to outgrow the game. It's actually quite amazing.
That's Daryl Horseman at the Ice Den in Scottsdale, curling. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org.
Comprehensive immigration reform was supposed to become a reality in 2013. The Senate's bipartisan Gang of Eight worked with union and business groups in the attempt to find compromise. And the plan got through the overall body, but the House then clamped down, with some conservatives saying they weren't interested in reform at all, while others thought some steps might be acceptable. Now it's 2014, and to credit Yogi Berra, it feels like deja vu all over again. House Speaker John Boehner wants his caucus to consider a piecemeal approach, and U.S. Chamber of Commerce President Tom Donohue says his organization is going to pull out all the stops to finally get immigration reform fully enacted. To tell us how significant that is or isn't is Tamar Jacoby, President and CEO of Immigration Works USA.
It is a huge factor. It's very important. It's very important in general to have business playing, and it's very important as powerful a force as the chamber. It's very important to have them playing. But, you know, we've seen a lot of in the past year, really, we've seen a lot of new players who haven't been there in the past get engaged much more. Businesses, one, and Chamber at the lead of that, but other businesses as well. Evangelicals are another big force we've seen engage over the past year. Latino voters and young Latinos have engaged in a way they've never engaged before. And I think what we're going to see in 2014 is a kind of culmination of this involvement by a lot of different players. And finally, frankly, Republicans in the House of Representatives realizing as a group that it is in their interest to be on the right side of this and be part of the solution. And I think the chances are really, really looking quite promising that we could get it done this year.
The chamber obviously is getting involved in it because it's a business group, so there's a business benefit. What's the biggest business benefit?
The economy, both the low end of the jobs market, farm workers, kitchen workers, hotel workers, American needs workers like that, and the high end of the job scale, PhD scientists and innovators and high-end business managers. American workers are clustered in the middle of that spectrum, mostly some education, more than a farm worker needs, but we don't have enough people to be the PhD scientists. And for the economy to be fully competitive, we need workers at both ends. And most businesses want them to be legal and want it to be easy and attractive to come here. There's a huge economic stake, and business recognizes that, and that's why business got more and more mobilized on this.
How significant is it that Speaker John Boehner is acting like he wants to take a lead on this?
You can't overestimate the significance. This is what we've been waiting for. This is what's been ripening over the past year or so. And I think it is finally coming. I keep using this metaphor of ripen and coming to fruition. I think that's the big thing that's coming to fruition. And I think it suggests that it really could happen. And, you know, let's not go crazy here, right? We're not breaking out the champagne yet. There's a lot of difficult negotiations, a lot of difficult choices, and a lot of difficult politics between now and then, both to get it done and to get it right. Right? This has to be a bill that actually works to solve the problem, and there's a lot of moving parts. So no champagne yet, but I think it's looking very promising.
So we talk about comprehensive, we talk about piecemeal. Where are you in those terms, and will it have to be piecemeal because the House has to go along with it?
Yeah, I think that's a distinction that is not as much of a difference as people have made it. Hmm. My metaphor is, if you're talking about a big feast, you can talk about it as one big feast, or you can talk about it as eight different courses, and it adds up to the same thing. And I think what the House is going to do this in a course by course manner, but I still think it could add up to a feast.
Tamar Jacoby is president and CEO of Immigration Works USA.
Some Democratic political leaders in Arizona have filed a lawsuit challenging part of a 2010 state law that expands the Maricopa Community College District's governing board. The provision in question adds two at-large seats to the board. The other five members each represent a specific district. Justin Levitt is a law professor at Loyola Law School in L.A. and says the plaintiff's rhetoric doesn't necessarily match what's in the suit.
It's based on state law. It's not a federal lawsuit, although I think that the underlying facts might well point to other federal causes of action. They've put it in state court under the Arizona state constitution, saying essentially, although this law looks like it applies all over the state, it's really singling out Maricopa. What I mean by that is the law purports to say any time you have a county over 3 million people, we're going to add two seats that the entire county elects to sit on the community college board. But really, there's only one county in the next 40 years or so that's going to be anywhere near that zone, and that's Maricopa County.
Does it make a difference, legally speaking, that the plaintiffs in this case, in general, were supportive of this law when it was going through the legislature?
It shouldn't. If there's a particular legal violation, then as long as the plaintiffs have been injured by it, and that's something they're going to have to prove, they have the right to bring a case. Now, there are all sorts of factors in the background, some of which may make the plaintiffs look less sympathetic, some of which may make the legislature look a whole lot less sympathetic, but it's not a legal bar.
Talking about the need to prove that, to prove injury in a case, legally speaking, how do you prove injury in a case when the election for these seats hasn't happened yet, and potentially one of the contenders for these seats is in fact a minority?
Well, it's interesting. The lawsuit that they've brought isn't actually based on race at all. It's based on singling out Maricopa County under the state constitution. There are other factors lurking in the background of this case, including very much whether these sorts of structures dilute the right to vote on account of race. But at least the initial papers for this case filed in state court don't really talk about that.
Is it safe to say then that a lot of the comments that the plaintiffs have made about the two new seats diluting the minority voice on the governing board, is that just sort of rhetoric and not necessarily at work in the courtroom itself?
It's not at work in this courtroom, legally speaking, yet. The plaintiffs could amend their filing papers and could add claims based on race or based on vote dilution. They could file a case in federal court. But right now, it's background texture for the case, which is, legally speaking, not precisely what the parties will argue about, but it's awfully difficult if you're a judge or if you're another fact finder to blind yourself to the context.
So given the fact that this case hasn't really started going through the hearing process and there are elections coming up in November, is it possible that the case could be decided and appeals exhausted before this law would actually take effect in November or at least leading up to the election?
It's possible, but unlikely. I think what's more likely is one of the parties will ask for early relief. And keep in mind, it's not just November, but campaign season before that that's really impacted. Could be postponing the elections, could be running the elections under the old system for now. It's more likely that one of the parties will ask for a temporary hold things in place measure until the legality is decided. But that's up to the parties to ask for.
Justin Levitt teaches law at Loyola Law School in L.A., specializing in election law. KJZZ is licensed to the Maricopa Community College District.
The Coyotes lost to the Minnesota Wild last night in Glendale 4-1. But team management is also paying attention to another number, 10,075, the attendance at last night's game. The Coyotes are last in the NHL in average attendance this season and have been either last or next to last in attendance each of the past four seasons.
But the Coyotes drew 16% more fans between October and December this year than during the same period of 2011. Only Dallas had better growth. And the Coyotes' new owners are optimistic about continuing that trend. Anthony LeBlanc is the Coyotes' co-owner, president, and CEO.
So far, we're actually quite happy with where things are. We obviously had a long-term plan in place when we were going through the acquisition process, and we have a turnaround plan that we envision will take a total of 2 to 3 years before we hit a point of being a profitable venture. And all of the metrics that we need to hit at this point are on track.
The Coyotes are last in the league in attendance this season. I would imagine that's got to be, at least in a little bit, a disappointment to you.
it is a little bit of a disappointment, but having that said, we are tracking towards where we expected to track for this point in the season. We came into this with eyes wide open and understanding when we have a stronger gait, and we know that the second half of the season is a stronger time for the Coyotes. So if we compare this historically to, for example, the last time the Coyotes had games played in the fall, which was 2 years ago due to the lockout last year, we're actually up about 20% attendance year over year.
How much of the attendance do you think is due to other things going on with other sports or other things going on in the Valley versus the ownership situation versus what fans see on the ice?
Well, I think the ownership situation and the stability we've been able to provide has certainly been a part of the reason that we've seen that 20% year-over-year growth from 11-12 to this year. But there's no question that people want to see an exciting product and they want to see a winning team.
So is it safe to say then that at least being in the playoff hunt, if not actually making the playoffs, are pretty important as far as how the gate goes?
Oh, absolutely. I'd say being in the playoff hunt and giving your fans the expectation that you are a playoff team is of critical importance to us.
So what kinds of things are you guys doing to try to increase attendance and get more people to the games?
Well, it's a multitude of things. I mean, we have obviously embraced a new marketing platform and a new PR agency that we work with here locally. But it's also just trying to do new things. We're trying to appeal to certain demographics that are here in the Valley. I mean, obviously, with the ownership group being a group of Canadians, we understand that there's a large number of not just Canadians but Northerners that spend a large proportion of the hockey season down here in the Valley. So we're putting together some plans that we think appeal to those individuals. But at the end of the day, we're just trying to ensure that the entertainment value on the ice, but also the entertainment value in the building, is something that people want to be a part of. So we're doing many things that we think will enhance that experience.
Is it realistic to think that eventually within the scope of your overall plan that the Coyotes would sell out every game or be in the top tier of attendance in the NHL?
I think it's fair to say that the goal that we've set for ourselves is to be in the middle of the pack of the NHL in regards to attendance, and that means, yes, it means selling out on a regular basis.
Do you feel like there's anything that the Coyotes have to prove to the rest of the NHL or the greater hockey world that after everything that happened with the ownership situation, the bankruptcy and everything else, that hockey can survive and thrive in the desert?
Well, I think we're already in the process of doing that. I think people forget that, you know, attendance is one thing, but there's also average ticket price, which has gone up in a significant manner this year. So overall, compared to the last couple of years, the Coyotes' revenues, just the local revenues, are up around 20% year over year. That's significant. And I think that if you ask others within the league and at the league offices, I think that they're encouraged by what they've seen so far. We know we have a lot of work left, but we're moving in the right direction.
Anthony LeBlanc is the co-owner, president, and CEO of the Phoenix Coyotes.
It's the show. Good afternoon with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. If you really, really, really like what you're hearing on the show or kind of don't like what you're hearing, let us know. If you have some great ideas about what's going on in your neck of the valley, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. Quick check of Valley traffic, couple of accidents, I-17 northbound at Thunderbird, and if you're on the 51 southbound, watch out for the shoulder being blocked by a collision at Indian School. Should be a very nice mild weekend around the valley, mostly to partly sunny skies both Saturday and Sunday, with highs around 72. It's currently mostly clear and 63 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts. Tony Award winner Brian Stokes Mitchell performs Broadway classics with the Phoenix Symphony, January 17th and 18th. Tickets at scottsdaleperformingarts.org.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And the three-man booth is complete with me, Steve Goldstein.
Man, don't we all need a good soundtrack to get us going? This tune was the opening credits to the movie The Devil Wears Prada. Each of the thinly veiled Condé Nasties working for Vogue, getting decked out in their clothes that kill.
For sure. I mean, I get revved up every morning before coming to the station.
Love and you is easy cause you're beautiful. Making love with you.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm having a tough time, I just think about how I'm going to spend this hour every single Friday and sort of where it fits into the rest of my life.
Talking about
also need killer music on the ice if you're an Olympic ice skater. And for Olympian Johnny Weir, it was Chopin. As a kid, he imagined himself landing perfect jumps to. Nocturne No. 20 in C sharp minor was his Olympic soundtrack, Dream Come True. But for Korean athlete Yuna Kim, different dream. Bond, James Bond themes produced a gold medal in the 2010 games for her. How to choose music for an audience, music that speaks to your own lifelong dreams and separates you from the pack. Challenge well known by Christy Yamaguchi, the 1992 Olympic gold medal winner in figure skating. Hello, Christy.
Hi, great. Thank you.
So what are the athletes doing right about now? Are they picking their music? Have they already picked it and they're just trying to live with it, maximize it?
The Olympics at this point are about a month away. So the skaters have really, most of them, I would say probably 99%, have been practicing to the same music this entire year and have done at least 2 to 3 competitions to kind of showcase it and test run it, as you may say.
What was the biggest risk you took in your skating playlist, do you think?
I would have to say, you know, it was a little bit more in my younger years, but there was one year that I skated to the theme song from the Jetsons. So, you know, it kind of was cute and a fun personality, but it was kind of a risk, yeah.
Let's hear it. That sounds kind of skatey. I sort of get the flow there, right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I didn't have the vocals for my competitive number, but, you know, it was peppy. It was upbeat, but, you know, I think the judges were kind of like, well, that was a little, you know, kitschy, and, you know, maybe next time stick to the classical music or whatever. So it's hard to please everyone.
Those picky judges. Maybe they concluded you were a robot as a skater, which probably wouldn't have been positive.
Yeah, you're probably right.
All right. You also chose one other cut, which suggests just how out of the box you can be. What's that?
You know, I remember another kind of polarizing routine, and that was the ice dance team of Paul and Isabelle Duchesnay, and it was in the 1988 Olympics. It was called Savage Right, and it was really innovative at the time, and I think people either loved it or they really disliked it. It was just very, very different for an ice dance team and, you know, very, very risky. But, you know, it's always about pushing the sport forward, I think, and trying different things.
Well, let's hear it.
It's clear that they have set a style and are committed to it.
They've set a style and are committed to it, which is a code for saying we have no idea what they're doing out there, right?
Right. Possibly.
Were you a lover or a hater of this?
You know, it was kind of one of those things that you saw and was like, I can't quite get it. And then my subsequent time seeing it, because I watched it more than once, it's hard not to appreciate it and appreciate the creativity in it. So I kind of liked it.
So is the music you won the gold medal to in the 90s the soundtrack for your finest moment, or do you never play that music ever again?
You know, it's a special music still. And, you know, my short program was The Blue Danube. And I think it just showcased, I think, my skating at one of its strongest.
Well, congratulations on your playlist and your medal winning.
Thank you very much.
Christy Yamaguchi is the 1992 Olympic champion in ladies and singles figure skating. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
Now, we have a good guess at what animals that lived many millions of years ago looked like, but what color were they? It's a question that even expert scientists couldn't confidently answer until perhaps now.
Because for the first time in fossilized remains, they found the chemical pigment that allows them to establish the animal's skin color.
And as the BBC's science reporter Rebecca Morrell explains, it would appear that many of the creatures were very dark.
Scientists looked at exquisitely preserved marine reptiles that lived up to 200 million years ago. They found that dark traces on their fossilized skin contained a type of melanin, a pigment that's responsible for color. The team says that one of the creatures, a giant predator called a mosasaur, contained so much melanin, it would have been very dark or black. The same was true for the 55-million-year-old turtle they examined. However, the researchers suspect these animals might have been lighter underneath. A dark topside would have helped them to absorb light and heat as they basked at the surface, but a pale belly provided camouflage from predators lurking below. Dr. Johan Lindgren from Lund University in Sweden says he's surprised he could extract these chemicals.
When I started off 20 years ago, actually, as a student at university, Jurassic Park that just came out. But back then it was impossible to, you know, get any sort of biomolecule from an animal that had been extinct for many millions of years, but suddenly here we are, you know, and it's just proud to be part of it.
Another animal that the team looked at, an ichthyosaur, which looks similar to today's dolphins, was black all over. This would have helped the deep-diving creature to absorb as much energy as possible whenever it came up for air, while remaining hidden when it returned to the dark depths.
That's the BBC's Rebecca Morrell.
Arizona is known for cattle, cotton, and citrus.
There's actually another item, though, that grows abundantly in this southwestern desert.
KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us what has beautified our West Valley fields for decades.
Arizona's climate is the ideal place to grow crops like alfalfa, spinach, and lettuce. Did you know Arizona is one of two states that grows most of the rosebush crop in the U.S.?
We're the rosebush capital of the United States.
Kyler Francis is a second-generation rosebush grower. Michael Francis Roses is his family-operated company, which is among a handful of rose farms in the West Valley. The company has been around for 25 years. The 2,000-acre farm is located in Litchfield Park in El Mirage. It sits next to Luke Air Force Base. Francis says there's more than 1,000 varieties of rose bushes grown here. He says Arizona is the ideal place to grow them.
We get 360 days of sun a year. We know when it's going to be hot. We know when it's going to be cold. We know when it's going to rain. Everything here is irrigated, and we're able to control how much fertilizer is going out. So creating these nice microclimates for these plants to grow is really easy.
Francis Roses is one of a handful of super wholesale rosebush growers in Arizona, meaning this farm sells hundreds of thousands of rose bushes to wholesale distributors who then sell to retailers like Walmart and home improvement stores. On this day, 60,000 rose bushes are harvested, cleaned, packed, and shipped to distributors to then be sold across the country.
Everything starts here. We plant them, we bud them, we take care of them, you know, we ship them out. You know, we're kind of the bloodline of the rose community at this point. If you have a rose bush that's in your garden, you know, there's a high probability that it came from us.
Francis says growing roses is easy. The trick is knowing what type of flower to plant. Not all varieties of roses do well in all climates. And by the way, the oldest living rose bush is 1,000 years old, blooming in a German cathedral. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
A lot of good stuff going on this weekend. Steve, one of the biggest things starting this weekend, the Barrett Jackson car auction. Lots of good stuff. If you got a couple $100,000 or $1 million burning a hole in your pocket, like I know that you do.
And Mark, last year I remember the Batmobile was one of the biggies. This year, 1972 Oldsmobile 442 convertible. If you're a fan of The Sopranos, that was previously owned by the late James Gandolfini.
You can also buy a 63 Chevy Impala custom convertible that was once owned by Kobe Bryant of the LA Lakers.
Boo.
Yes,
right?
Indeed. boo, yes.
And in addition to some other things, singer Steven Tyler, your buddy from Aerosmith, will be auctioning two motorcycles. Also, NASCAR driver Rusty Wallace's car.
And I don't know if owning this car would make you a mean, nasty person, but a 2008 Bugatti two-door coupe currently owned by Simon Cowell. In 2008, this was the fastest street-legal vehicle in this country.
Wow, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, good luck. Good thing for him there's no photo radar on the 101 anymore.
And coming up on Monday, just to mark, it's the 50th anniversary of Celebrity Theater. I've seen a couple of concerts there over the years. 50 years, kind of amazing.
And this weekend also, Disney on Ice, Rockin' Ever After at U.S. Airways Center. You can see all the princesses from Ariel to Brave's Meridia.
And we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that Sunday afternoon, starting at 1 p.m., the No Pants Light Rail, I think that speaks for itself.
Yeah.
Tasteful is the most important word there, tasteful.
So we've been talking about music and everybody, how everybody needs a soundtrack, something to get them pumped up in the morning or pretty much any time. We should tell you that the show was produced this week by John Hoban and Nick Blumberg, who uses Elvis Costello's Pump It Up to do just that.
Also thanks to Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, also with help from Tiara Vian, who we consistently have a hard time pronouncing her name, so it's the Ting Tings.
Ironically, I think you did pronounce her name correctly this week, so nice job with that. Also, thanks to Kendra Sabo, who likes Ritual Union from Little Dragon. Our digital team is Tracy Greer, who's been waking up to this.
Julie Levin's a fan of the Beatles' Good Day Sunshine. Our managing editor, Al Macias. Our news director is Peter O'Dowd. Want to hear from you at the show at kjzz.org. Hope you have a great weekend. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD.